Accession number 16395, Reel 4.
General Crookenden, Reel 4.
Preble village disappeared under this tremendous bombardment. Men of the rear companies of the 12th Parachute Battalion and of the 12th Devon's D Company were still hurrying up the lane which led to the start line. One of the company commanders of the Devon, the support company commander, who didn't have much to do, had gone to see for a plan to watch his old friend John Bamfield go into action. From our brigade headquarters, 2.5-3 miles away down by the river, we could see the bombardment start. We saw the village disappear in its usual mass of flames and explosions. And I heard later what happened. This Major Eddie Warren, as he walked up towards the start line, he noticed, in fact a lot of the men involved in the attack noticed, that some of the shells from the rear, our own artillery firing over their heads, were passing extraordinarily close overhead. And while at about 5 to 10, the German counter-battery fire started on the start line, there's no question that a number of British shells were landing there as well. The 12th Battleship Battalion and the 12th Devons were both hit by this combination of German and British artillery shells. The commanding officer of the 12th Battleship Battalion, Johnny Johnson, was killed. So it is RSM and adjutant, and as John Bamfield from the Devons had gone up to meet him to receive his orders in an orchard just behind the start line, he too was killed. And Eddie Warren, this spare company commander floating about the battlefield as a spectator, found all four of these men lying in the field dead. A number of the attacking battalion and the Devons company were severely hit by this bombardment. Nearly all the officers and NCOs were hit one way or another. But it does great credit to those soldiers that at 10 o'clock, HR, the barrage lifted, and they went forward through the smoke towards the village. Three tanks of the 13th and 18th Hussars were firing into the village to support the infantry. And down at Brigade Headquarters, we could hear the sound of the artillery barrels stopping. A short pause as the infantry advanced over the 500 yards of open fields, and then the sound of rifle, machine gun fire and grenades echoing through the village as they fought it out. The next thing which was surprising was the two white valley lights soared up from the south end of the village, the enemy end, as it still was. Nobody still knows to this day who fired them, British or German. But the result was, and you could hear it clearly, the rumble of guns, the same artillery, our own, opening fire from beyond the Orne, reoccurred. Hear it again. And many of us, and many of the people attacking, thought it was our own artillery opening fire beyond the village in the normal way you arrange it, so that beyond your objective, the artillery fire a protective screen of shells to stop the inevitable German counterattack. But this time, the artillery had repeated the same program, and all 100 guns were once again bringing down that opening concentration on the village of Breville itself. Complete mayhem in the village. Most of it was smashed flat. The church caught fire, and in the upward draft from the flames, a high note on the organ stuck open, and to the general confusion and din of battle was added this wailing high note from the organ. The 12th Battalion and this few men of the Devons cleared the village, chased the Germans out, suffered heavily themselves, and so by about midnight, perhaps 1 o'clock, up on the ridge there, it all quietened down. In fact, two of the 13th Hussars tanks had rumbled forward in the night to strengthen the defense of the village, taking up positions on the crossroads. And next morning, my job was to bring up a fresh battalion of the Royal Ulster Rifles, one of our glider battalions, take over from the remnants of the attacking force and consolidate this village now at last, finally, in our hands. As soon as they'd taken over, the remnants of the 12th Parish Battalion, 55 men, marched away down the hill to rest in fields near the Orne River, together with the remnants of the Devon's company. And that day, with a working party from various units of the battalion, we buried 77 Germans and a large number of British. The British, of course, we took down to our own divisional cemetery in the village of Romville. It had been a costly affair. 25 years later, I was standing in the village describing the battle to the students of the Army Staff College when the village policeman, the gendarme, passed me on his bike with a sack over his shoulder. I knew him quite well. He took me aside, opened his sack, and in it were the dog tags, identity discs, and boots of a German soldier whom they'd just dug up from the ruins of one of the village houses now being rebuilt. So 78 Germans were killed in that attack. I pause there, can I? No one knows to this day what had happened or why that second concentration of fire on the village had taken place. The only man who might have known the answer, the forward observing officer, Hugh Ward, a very splendid young man and a very brave officer from our own light regiment, who with his Jeep radio set and operator had moved forward with the attack during the night to establish himself in the middle of the village near the church which finally caught fire, and there he'd been killed by our own guns. It certainly wasn't his fault, but no number of inquiries has ever discovered how it occurred. An interesting psychological fact of morale, perhaps, is I've never heard any soldier from any of the regiments involved say a single word of complaint or criticism of our own gunners. After all, they had saved our bacon so many times in the past and will do so again in the future. Two of the casualties from this Battle of Breville were Brigadier Hugh Kindersley, my own brigade commander, and Brigadier Lord Lovett, who commanded the commander of brigade, who had been holding the village of Omproville from which this attack had been launched. They had both been worried by the hastiness of the attack. They had both come forward to almost the start line, and they were both talking in a big farmyard 200 yards behind the start line when this bombardment, partly German, partly British, had started. One shell burst in the entrance to the farmyard, and a piece of shell entered Lord Lovett's stomach and appeared to emerge from his back. And Hugh Kindersley's case, his right leg had both femur and pelvis shattered by this shell burst. Happily for Lord Lovett, he had a freak wound where this shell piece had skidded round his ribs. So what looked like a terrible penetrating wound had in fact been a nasty but sort of surface wound, and he recovered fully. They were both taken back to England in the same stretcher jeep and then hospital ship. Hugh Kindersley was lame for the rest of his life from his wounded leg. As a result of that, for 2 or 3 days we had no brigade commander, but we had 3 experienced commanding officers, and General Gale, having sent for me, said, "We shall wait 2 or 3 days before we get you in your glider brigade, a new brigadier. Meanwhile, you'll be able to quite happily carry on with your 3 experienced COs and brigade headquarters." A few days later, the new brigadier arrived, a man with a tremendous record in World War I. He'd won the Military Cross 3 times in the great German breakthrough of March 1918. And he was one of the early parachute soldiers in the British Army in 1940-41. We were delighted to have him as our brigade commander. Our chief administrative staff officer, the DAQ, Dick Crawshaw, and I had made out a detailed takeover plan for the new brigadier, visiting battalion, seeing the gunners, and all the usual drill. But to our regret and considerable distress, he refused to leave his dugout for the next week or so, and we came to the conclusion, after a lot of worried talk amongst ourselves, that he was worn out mentally and that his stock of courage had been so run down during his military life that he had none left. But happily, before we could bring this problem to a solution, I was posted. I was sitting in our big dugout, our command post, we dug with great care, one evening when the field telephone rang and the senior staff officer, the GSO1 of our division, Lieutenant Colonel Bobby Bray, rang me on the phone and said, "Napier, the CO of the 9th Parachute Battalion, Terence Otway, has been evacuated as a casualty. You are to go up tomorrow morning and take over command of that battalion. You'll have to watch out. There are only 130 of them left. Their tails are down, and you, of course, although you're parachute trained, you're not in the regiment, in that regiment. You're a Cheshire, and you may find some problem." Next morning, I walked up through the orchards to find the 9th Battalion, who were in the line in contact with the enemy, and found great difficulty in finding them. Eventually, I came upon an officer and 2 private soldiers sitting in the slit trench and asked who they were, where could I find the 9th Parachute Battalion. And the officer, a young fellow, gave a great grin and said, "We're it, sir." This was Hugh Pond, in civilian life and reporter on the Daily Express, and 2 soldiers in the sickle platoon. I asked them where the companies were, where was the location map, where was their strength state, where was their ammunition state, where were their documents, where was brigade battalion headquarters, and the clerks. Oh, they said, "There's only us left," very cheerfully. And so that afternoon, I went round the 3 rifle companies, each about 30 or 40 men left, and instead of finding them in low morale or downhearted, I found them at the very top of their spirits. They'd been there in Normandy for a month. They'd killed a lot of Germans, and their tails were right up. They gave me a tremendous welcome, and I did a further 2.5 years with those people, some of the best officers and men I've ever had the privilege of serving with. Now, I must pause.
Did you see any fighting with the 9th Battalion in Normandy?
Yeah, a little bit. I'll do that now, if you like.
Please.
So, for the next 6 weeks, we held static positions in the Bois de Bavon. We spent our time patrolling every night, firing mortar concentrations to tickle up the enemy, and relieving each other from time to time in the forward positions. Then on the 17th of August, the orders came to advance to the Seine, together with the rest of the British Army advancing. We walked forward through the Bois de Bavon, through the flooded marshes of the River Dives, and so onto the higher ground beyond it to the east. Our first task as a battalion was to capture a crossing over the River Dives at the Dodgelet-Puteaux station, the railway station of a little village called Dodgelet, a little further up the hill. Part of the general advance of 6th Armoured Division, 3rd Parachute Brigade, and on our right, the 5th Parachute Brigade. In our particular case, the main road bridge over the river had been blown, and so had a railway bridge a mile further north. But the railway bridge was only down in the river, and its girders could still be climbed across on the outside. I decided to capture this railway station, Dodgelet-Puteaux, by night attack, left flanking, climbing over the railway bridge and down the railway line to the south, and so into the station and the few bits of village houses around it. We crossed the river in the middle of the night. The only incident there, which I remember clearly, is that as we climbed across the outside of these broken-down girders, behind me, in the ordinary way, was a signaller carrying my rover set, the radio set which always went with me, which I controlled the movement of the companies. He lost his footing halfway across the river. It was, in fact, a canal, this bit of water. Flung his arms around my neck, pulling me off the girder, and we both disappeared into the water. However, we recovered, climbed back onto the girder, and got across the canal, rather wet. We then advanced down the line of the railway into the station, led by A Company and a very good sergeant called Sergeant Frith. The Germans opened fire as we entered the station and the station hotel in the night. Sergeant Frith was killed, and the rest of the companies, without difficulty, chased out the rest of the Germans and took over the station in the ordinary positions of all-round defence. Next morning, the Germans counterattacked fairly seriously, infantry and self-propelled guns. I put A Company in the station hotel on the left of our position, B Company forward right, and C Company in rear of the station as reserve. And with my adjutant, intelligence officer at regimental sergeant major, and my battalion headquarters radio, we took cover from the shelling and SB gun fire, lying on the rails under cover of the station platform. We beat off the German counterattack without much difficulty, but the sad incident was that halfway through that morning's battle, a young officer who had joined us from the beach group to make up our strength, and who was then commanding a platoon, which he just arrived, in A Company and holding the bottom part of the station hotel, didn't like it, took off, left his platoon, ran across the station platform, and ill-advisedly jumped down into the middle of my little group, our battalion headquarters. The regimental sergeant majors, an amusing and rather cheerful parachute warrant officer, as this wretched man ran through us, or got up to run further, stuck out his foot, tripped him up and said, "Excuse me, sir, where are you going?" Of course, running away. In World War One, he'd have been shot. But in this case, we sent him back to our medical officer, Bobby Marquis, probably the best medical officer in the Army, and he was sent back down the line and returned to England. It was another interesting example of how battle shock affects different people. That poor young man would probably never recover, and he had none of the advantages of having trained together, of being in the same regiment, of knowing everybody else in his company. He'd come into it absolutely straight from a reinforcement camp on the beaches. I should add that the 200 men who joined us, officers and men, from those camps, all the rest of them, behaved extremely well, and nearly all of them joined the parachute regiment later on. So that was the end of our battling in Normandy. We advanced without much opposition to the village of Berzerville, not far from the Seine. We had a minor scrap with the German garrison of Berzerville. I did lose 2 or 3 soldiers, sadly. We were feted by the town of Berzerville, who had escaped the unpleasant fate of being liberated by the Allies. They were intact in every way. And then we returned to England to retrain, to fill up with more men. Perhaps I can add one incident of our 4 days' wait at Berzerville for transport home. The 9th Parachute Battalion, which I was now commanding, had landed at 10:10 on D-Day morning and had silenced the coastal battery at Merville. They'd attacked the battery with 150 men, all they could gather after a very scattered drop, and they left the battery for the further fighting on that D-Day with only 80 men on their feet. So we knew a number of our soldiers had been killed at that battery. So during our short breathing space at Berzerville, the Padre, 15 men, a 3-ton truck, and myself drove back to Merville to see if we could locate some of our dead. We failed to. They'd all been buried, or they disappeared, though many of them came to light in later years. But we did find a certain spot on a lane in that area of Normandy where we knew a lot of the men dropped far away on that early D-Day morning, led by Brigadier Hill himself, who'd landed 9 miles to the east, had been caught at 7 o'clock in the morning of D-Day as they made their way back towards our lines. They'd been caught by Allied heavy bombers bombing through cloud in advance of the seaborne landings. They all heard the whistle of heavy bombs coming down. James Hill shouted. They all jumped into the ditch, and James Hill has often told me how they were caught in this stick of heavy bombs, terrifying experience. He knew he'd been wounded in the bottom as he lay flat on his stomach in the ditch. And when he came to after the concussion and noise, he saw lying in the road beside him a brown boot, just a boot. And he thought he must have lost his leg, except he realized it wasn't his because he had black boots. Practically everybody in that group of 40 men was killed or wounded, except 3 or 4 of them. Lieutenant Peters, who'd been the mortar officer of the 9th Parachute Battalion, had been blown completely off the Brigadier, and all we ever found of him was his boot and his foot inside it. And Brigadier James himself was quite badly wounded in the bottom. His story is a different one and a very fascinating one. But when we got back there in September, we found this spot, and we could tell it was the right place because it was covered, still covered, in British Army equipment, clothing, debris. There are no sign of any bodies. But in the stick of bombs, the bomb hole nearest the road had been filled in, And I could see sticking out of the earth where it had been filled in a piece of cloth from an airborne smock, clearly the place where the Germans had thrown all our men's bodies. We dug it all out, and we found 17 bodies, largely in bits, and we reburied them in the field with rough crosses. At the bottom of the pit we found Glenn, the war dog, the battalion war dog who had jumped with the battalion at 10 to 1 on D-Day morning. And I remember we were trying to locate the forearm by itself, and the army watch on the forearm's wrist was numbered, and later on we checked that it belonged to the mortar corporal of the 9th Battalion. And rather curious afternote to that is that I cut the watch off this rather decaying forearm, wound it up, and it went for the rest of the war. We felt a curious feeling of having done something worthwhile, and the fact we'd gone back and led by the padre, reburied these 17 men, was very much appreciated by the rest of the battalion. I put that down to General Gale. Before we left England, in all our briefing for D-Day, in talking about battle, which he knew a lot from the First World War, he said, "You must pay attention to the proper handling of the dead, if you can." And as soon as we landed in Normandy, where we were lucky enough to remain on the same site or general area for 6 weeks, he established near the center of the divisional area, Ronville Church, a field which became our divisional burial ground. And all our orders from the general were that if we possibly could, we would take our dead down to this field and give them a proper reverend burial. You couldn't always do that, but if you could, we did. And for 10 years, every one of our over 1,000 graves in that field were adopted by French families, and fresh flowers put on their graves and kept there until 10 years later the Commonwealth War Graves Commission took over and made it the beautiful place it is now. All right. We then came back to England, September to December, where we got a whole lot of new men. We retrained ourselves. We did a lot of major exercises. We worked hard, feeling all the time rather guilty about the rest of the army who were fighting their way through Normandy, Belgium, Holland, and the Rhine, and Germany, up to the Rhine. However, just before Christmas 1944, we suddenly got the order on the 23rd of December. The next day, Christmas Eve, we were to leave by road transport straight away for Belgium, where the Germans had very nearly broken through the American armies in the Battle of the Bulge. So we rapidly organized